Hello, welcome to Mod Midwives, a Metro Midwifery podcast. I'm Gina Gerbaugh.
And I'm Nedra Hale, and we are home birth midwives serving the Denver metro area.
Well, we have a special treat for everybody today. We are interviewing Aubrey Tompkins, the author of Midwifery for Expectant Parents, A Modern Guide to Choosing the Birth That's Right for You. Welcome, Aubrey.
Hi, how's it going? I'm so happy to be here.
Good. I'm glad. We haven't had a chance to be, I mean, we're all in the same city and we haven't been at a conference or anything like that for a long time.
No. So.
I know. Dang COVID.
I know. It's messed with all the stuff.
It has.
And you've had a lot of changes.
We'll just have to make up for it.
Yeah, for sure. Oh my gosh. When COVID is over, I'm hugging all the people and going all the places.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure. Yes.
Yeah. Well, do you want to give our audience a little introduction about yourself and who you are and why you wrote the book?
Sure. As you said, my name's Aubrey Tompkins. I am a midwife. I have been working in birth centers pretty much my entire career as a midwife, which is 11 years, somewhere around there, right around there. As a midwife, I do have some hospital experience as a midwife because the current birth center that I am at right now, we have hospital privileges as well.
Right.
And that birth center that I work at right now is called Seasons Midwifery and Birth Center. We opened in 2019, like 18 months ago, year and a half ago. It seems like super short and super long all at the same time.
Yeah.
I was working on it for 2 years before it opened, kind of all the behind the scenes work. And that's one of my babies, the birth center, and I love it. And I was just elected as the president of the American Association of Birth Centers, which is pretty cool. I am equally
really cool.
Excited and terrified.
Yeah, that's really awesome. That's great to have, you know, a little more just invested, you know, time invested in things that are really important to you.
Yeah. Birth centers are my jam. Particularly also my jam is community birth, is really what it's about for me, is bringing the birth back to the community and out of the focus of the hospital for the majority of folks who are low risk and healthy. So,
right. It's not for everybody, but
no,
but it is feasibly right for, you know, probably over 90% of people, birthing people.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. That's awesome. Yeah. And I know I don't want to speak for Nedra, but I probably do. I think that we believe that, the more community birth choices you have, the better, because it normalizes community birth.
For sure.
Rather than normalizing, which might be a good quick, do you want to explain about the term community birth? Speaking
sure.
of normalizing.
Right. Speaking of normalizing. So traditionally speaking, or maybe historically speaking, there's been the term out of hospital birth. And there's been a real move and a push to step away from that language, because when you say out of hospital, it makes hospital the focus, and it makes it seem as though the hospital is the thing that is quote unquote normal, and you are doing something out of the normal. And so taking that word hospital out of it and completely, which encompasses community birth. Also, community birth encompasses both birth in the home and birth in the birth center. So it's a term that can cover both places, respectively. And again, it just takes that locus of control away from the hospital and just talks about where the birth is happening itself.
Right. And, you know, we see that in a lot of the language choices that we're kind of moving towards. I don't know.
Language is powerful.
Yeah, language is really powerful.
Well, you want to take in other things too, you want to take the power away from the thing that's been in control, right?
Yeah.
And try to yeah. bring it to the people.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even delayed cord clamping is a problematic term.
I don't like that term either. Yeah.
yeah
I don't like right. delayed cord clamping because it makes it sound like you're doing something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like to use the term premature cord clamping because that means that you are doing something before you perhaps should.
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole other rabbit hole to go down, right?
That is. There was, for sure.
There were no studies, no evidence, no nothing to show that right. premature cord clamping was beneficial for the baby. It just started happening in the 1900s because it was easier for the medical system to do it that way. And now we right. are supposed to prove and give evidence as right. to why we should not do that. And it just really bothers me.
Right. It's proving the negative. You know, my yes, son had to yes. once prove that he didn't have asthma. Like,
right.
It's actually kind of hard to do. To
prove yes, that, exactly.
Prove that the asthma that you didn't have is resolved.
Right.
Not very logical. That was a government thing, just in case you were yeah. wondering. Yeah. So I love it. I love the language change around community birth. And I know that we feel like the more options we have, the more normal community birth becomes. And, you know, people, it just benefits all of us when, you know, there's more options in our community. So.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, I did notice that you talked about physiologic cord clamping is what I would have said.
Yes.
not prematurely clamping the cord in the
book.
It
depends on who you're talking to, right? Like, if I want to point things out, I don't know. Physiologic is... I feel it's the more proper term. I use premature as like a little sticker. Like
it's got a little wrist based.
Yeah, exactly.
uh-huh. Yeah, I thought that was great. I thought the book had a really great discussion about postpartum time and, you know, even the weaning. Sometimes we talk about the weaning of the midwifery relationship. You know, you really do cover a lot of those kind of important postpartum considerations because the birth doesn't end with the baby coming out.
Oh no. Really just the beginning.
Right. For sure. So I thought that was really great. I also noticed a lot of themes of collaboration in the book. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about why that was obviously something really important to you. I could feel it in the themes throughout the book.
Good. I'm glad because it is really important to me. I think the way our current structures are designed, there can be an encouragement of some animosity or hostility between the different silos, right? So we're all kind of siloed in our own places. There's the community birth midwives, and then even between community birth midwives, between home birth and birth center, there's little silos, and then there's the hospital midwives, and then there's the obstetricians and the maternal fetal medicine specialists. And the way our system is currently set up is there is animosity that can happen between. And I think one of my big crusades in my career, or the soapboxes that I like to get up and rant from, is that we need to break those down and all collaborate together, because really we all should have the same goal of healthy families. And when we fight amongst each other, it just defeats everybody's purpose. And so I am a huge proponent of working particularly with obstetricians and recognizing the positive. You know, obstetricians are expert surgeons. They are skilled surgeons. It's a surgical specialty. And I want an obstetrician that I work with to be a real good surgeon. Because
right.
that's what I want them for, right? I don't expect an obstetrician to labor sit and do all of that stuff that midwives do, because they have other jobs to do, right? And their jobs aren't better or worse than our jobs. The skills aren't better or worse. They're just different. And so I think it's an acknowledgement of everybody's and each profession's skills. If we could all just do that and get along, then it would be a really nice world, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And I think there's kind of a historical, because midwives were marginalized for so long, I think there can be this sort of hesitancy to reach out to collaborate. But in fact,
absolutely,
collaboration is really normal in any kind of healthcare system. I actually just had a client who, she was planning a cesarean birth for, you know, reasons we don't need to go into, but she was in labor earlier than the scheduled, or pre-labor earlier than the scheduled C-section. And so I was talking to the obstetrician about it. The obstetrician, I had been collaborating the whole time because I was providing prenatal care. And the obstetrician said, okay, I have clearance from MFM to do. So like, they can't just do whatever they want either. Like, you know, there's sort of this multi-layer of checks and balances or accountability. And and I think that's great to know that, you know, somebody's checking in with somebody else. And it's just something that, like you said, it just increases the safety.
Yeah. No one should work in a vacuum.
Right.
None of us should. We all should have other providers in our communities that we can consult and collaborate with, right? Like, I need to be able to call and talk to pediatricians. And that's really important. And so you need to keep those lines open. Like, the more communicating we have, the better. And I don't want to sound too Pollyanna, because I know this is an entrenched structural issue that we have in the U.S. Right. maternity care system. And right. so it is real, and it takes time and effort and work, but it can happen.
Right. And in your book, you talk about, you know, things to look for when choosing a midwife, which is, you know, funnily enough, what we did last week for our podcast. you talk about, you know, are they integrated in the system? And I want you to talk a little bit more about that. You know, what does that look like?
I mean, I think every provider, a midwife, I mean, we'll talk about midwives because that's what the question was, but every provider needs to have other providers that they can consult and collaborate with. So even from midwife to midwife, right? So I am just a human being and I have my own foibles and faults, and I might remember something that somebody else doesn't. So even just from midwife to midwife, you have to have other midwives that you can bounce things off of and run things by and have clinical scenarios, you know, in the HIPAA compliant ways and all of that stuff. But we need to be able to ask each other questions. So you need to have collaboration in that first inner circle. And then you need to have collaboration with other providers, obstetricians, maternal fetal medicine specialists, pediatricians, family practice. All of that is really important. And so if I was a consumer choosing a midwife in the community birth setting, I would want to know what their integration in the community is. And if somebody thinks that they don't need to do that, or that they're above that, or they're, for some reason, they can justify why they don't have that, to me, that is a huge red flag of, whoopsie, I don't want to maybe keep talking to this person. Because again, we are all just humans and individuals, and we need to have those structures around us, those checks and balances, like you said. That's a really great way to put it.
Yeah. And I think that sometimes when people read these lists of questions to ask their midwife, they're sort of misleading. So one question that they might suggest is, who's your backup physician? It's not always such a cut and dried relationship.
Correct.
And I sensed that nuance in your book.
Yeah.
That it was a little more complicated.
It doesn't mean that a community-based midwife has to have a specific provider that they can do X, Y, and Z with. It means that they have to have a network and a community that they can hook into, right, to make those things happen when they need to.
Yeah,
right.
Because there's not, the other side of it, the flip side is, in some communities, it's really difficult to find medical providers or professionals who will consult and collaborate with community providers. So it's, the onus is also on them as well, right? Like, you have to be able to have someone who's willing to do that. And if you don't in your community, you just have to have a plan for how that works and looks for you for those families that are going to need that care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That was great. How about, another theme that I noticed, and, you know, it wasn't necessarily something that you talked about in a specific section, but I definitely saw themes of informed choice and shared decision-making running throughout the book too. And I thought you might want to talk a little bit about how that influenced your, the writing.
I mean, I think it all boils down to that, right? It all boils down to we as the midwives, I always tell people I come with a ton of education, a lot of experience, you know, many years and many births. And so I bring that to the table. And then the clients also come with all of their lived years of experience. And nobody knows your body better than you. And nobody knows your family and your community and your culture and your systems that you live in better than you. And the clients, my knowledge does not negate or override the client's knowledge. They're equal together. Mm-hmm. And I always tell families, it's my job as the provider to have all of this information to lay it out for you. Like, here's mm-hmm. all these options that you have. And if we talk about option A, here's why it even exists. mm-hmm. Here's what it's looking for. Here's the risks of doing it, the risks of not doing it, the benefits. You know, we always talk about that stuff. And then it's my job as the provider, once I've put that on the table, to stand back and let the family pick up off the table what they want. Now, that's not always easy. It's really mm-hmm. hard.
Yeah.
Informed consent and shared decision-making is really hard for a provider, I find, because mm-hmm. I have my own biases and my own knowledge and my own experience and all of my stuff, right? And mm-hmm. I know what I chose with my pregnancies and my births. And there's a certain amount of letting go that you have to do, right? When you are encouraging people to make their own choices when they have all the information. And it mm-hmm. takes time. It takes energy. You mm-hmm. have to know your stuff. You have to really know your stuff all the time and stay up to date on things. And then you have to be willing to have people make choices you don't agree with. And that's hard and that's okay. But I think that's why it doesn't happen a lot in the traditional medical system, right? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. there's that, we have to take care of you, we know better sense
right.
that can happen, that paternalistic thing that can happen sometimes. mm-hmm. yeah. So it's really important to me, the shared decision-making, yeah.
And sometimes it's challenging too, because we have limitations. You know, we have Absolutely. Limitations by our license or our practice guidelines or yes. things like that. And Nedra, you always talk about, you know, there's also our personal safety sometimes as mm-hmm. a consideration too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so there's those are tricky, you know, like for example, labs would be the thing, you know, there's certain labs that I really want to have for my personal safety.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I tell people is that if I have my, I call them my like, no, like, these are my things, right? Like, these are my lines that I have to do, right? Like, for me and my practice at my birth center, our thing is we have to have an initial OB labs, and those labs have to have a blood type and an RH, and we have to do a CBC. And then I also want to have an HIV, a hepatitis B, a hepatitis C, and an RPR and a gonorrhea and chlamydia at the beginning yep. of your pregnancy. And the flip side of that is that if there is someone who, a family who feels really strongly that they don't want to do those things, that's 100% fine. And they need to find a provider who can meet those needs for them, right? Right. Like that's the other thing is I don't have to be everything for everybody. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we as providers are allowed to have our lines in the sand as well, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And yeah. just again, I always think I don't have to be the world's midwife.
Right. What do you say, Nedra? A midwife for every person?
Maybe. I don't know what to say.
You have an expression, but yeah, it's not.
But we don't have to right. be that. We don't have to be right. that person. There's
no,
a
midwife, you
there's
don't.
A midwife that fits for everybody.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. exactly. Absolutely.
yeah.
And some of those are the laws that we have to do, mm-hmm. right? So right. like at the birth center in the state of Colorado, per our regulations, people cannot go past 42 weeks. If I didn't work in a birth center and I was in a private solo practice, could I maybe have different practice guidelines around that strict line? Maybe I would, you know, but right now, because of the rules, I can't. And again, so those kind of non-negotiable things that we have at the birth center, we're just super upfront about them from the beginning. Like, here's the deal. We're going to draw labs when you start care. We have to do screening for gestational diabetes. We have all different ways we can do the screening. We have lots of ways to do it, but we have to do it. And you know, one of my other big non-negotiables is being able to use the Doppler in labor. That's a big one.
Yes. It's on our list too.
Yeah. That's one of my lines. Like,
it's really hard to hear the nuances of how the baby's doing with the fetoscope and everybody and has to be quiet.
Yeah. I think it's more disruptive to the labor process actually, because they can't be in certain positions if they're
in
water. Yeah, if they're in the water on their hands and knees, and then you have to tell them to get up. Like, I feel like the Doppler is actually much less invasive than the fetoscope in labor, but that's.
I think some of these things are actually, I mean, many people come to us having never had a hospital birth. So the, you know, the frame of reference is different for some people.
Right.
But they're very minor restrictions, and also I think they give people more mobility, more movement. Mm-hmm. If I was worried about somebody, if I didn't feel confident that they didn't have a communicable disease, I couldn't just dive into the birth tub. You know, I don't really dive myself into the birth tub.
Absolutely.
But.
I mean, we all try not to, but let's be real. It happens every once in a while.
I mean, there's just, right. Like, if I don't feel that comfortable, then you have less mobility.
Right.
So yeah, it actually serves.
And we're allowed to protect ourselves too, right?
Yeah.
Like, we are allowed to have protections for ourselves. I mean, that's our own human autonomy and rights as individuals, correct? So my clients' rights also don't override my rights.
Right. I mean, this has never been more of an issue than it is right now with COVID.
Right.
I mean, this is definitely something that's coming up in our communities. Do you want to talk about maybe how has COVID changed your policies at the birth center and your thoughts around that?
It's been hard. You know, I was joking with somebody that I should have always had on my list of things that I never want to have happen to me is to be the director of a healthcare facility during a global pandemic. right? Because it's kind of not fun.
Right.
You know, because there's all the constraints that we as community-based midwives are having to do with how we provide the one-on-one care for the birth, right? And that is heartbreaking and difficult and infuriating, and we hate it just as much as the clients hate it, right? I mean, I hate being in an N95 mask and a face shield and the stupid gloves up to my elbows. I hate it, and I hate it for hours when it happens. And I have to do it, right? And it sucks. So there's all of that stuff too. And then throw on top of that a facility, right? Because the birth center is a facility, and how we have been managing that has been hard. I think one of the hardest parts for me about the birth center setting right now is having to limit siblings. Because one of my favorite things at births is siblings. And it breaks my heart to have to limit siblings to come to births, but we just have to protect the facility and the staff and the people. And so that's a really hard decision. Of course, acquiring the PPE has been an adventure, as we all know, of those of us who have been trying to do that.
Yes. PPE that fits properly is our big challenge.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Yeah. And let's not even get on about the N95s and how you're supposed to have a fitting and certain types fit different facial features, and none of us, nobody's talking about that right now. We're all just, if you can get an N95, you just wear it.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, it's hard. I think some things have been good from it, from COVID. You know, we were talking earlier before you started recording. I think that it has really helped families to see that perhaps the hospital isn't the best place to go for every family, especially if you're low risk and healthy, that maybe there's another place you should go. You know, I think hospitals are fantastic places for people who are high risk or people who have an illness or something like that. But I don't think that they best serve the majority of pregnant people who are low risk and healthy. And I think it overserves them actually in a negative way. It's also about proper distribution of healthcare resources. The hospital should be saving their resources for those people who really need them. You know, so I think that's a positive part of COVID is people kind of realizing, oh, hey, maybe I don't want to go to that place where all the sick people are.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I don't think that's been the majority of people that have transferred to our care during COVID. I think it is more about wanting their families around them and their support people. Although to be clear, we have the same restriction on siblings for office visits.
Yeah.
It's so hard. And I just don't want to be this person that is on top of them about touching everything. And they literally do touch everything.
It's their job as children.
They can't
to
not
touch
do
everything.
It. I know. It's how they experience
purpose.
The world.
Yes.
So yeah. So it's just, and it just takes us so much longer to sanitize because we sanitize between each client.
Oh yeah.
So.
Us too. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, I think that has been maybe the bigger ultimate reason that people have shifted. But I do think people have made decisions that they might not have made, you know, if it
Absolutely.
Hadn't been for COVID.
Yeah. And that's another reason why people have come to us too, is the whole who can be with them at their birth thing. And the other thing is I refuse. I will go on record. I've said this before, to make a person in labor wear a mask. And there are facilities that are doing that. And I can't do that.
Yeah. It's too much. And we're
too
very
much.
Cautious.
I have to draw a line somewhere. Yeah. I'm super conscious too. And we're doing all these things that, you know, behind the scenes and stuff, but yeah, that's a line, you know, we're talking about lines that we each have a few minutes ago. And that is definitely one of mine. Like I can't ever demand that somebody in labor wears a mask. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine having to do that.
Have you had transfers? I'm sure you have since COVID, where you've accompanied them to the hospital, and how has that changed procedurally?
I'm really lucky because the hospital that I work in is being very flexible with that. So they pretty much have the same rules that we do. So when somebody comes to the birth center, we have to ask them and make sure that they've had no known exposures and no symptoms. And we take everybody's temperature, and everybody except the person in labor has to wear a mask, the partner, the doula, a photographer, if they have one, or a family member. The big difference at the hospital is that the one that we transfer to, they are allowing two support people. Those people have to wear masks, and the laboring person has to wear a mask if they're out of their room. If they leave their room, but they're being
reasonable.
They're being pretty reasonable so far with them when they're actually in labor.
Mm-hmm. We've had just a couple transfers since COVID started, one intrapartum and one postpartum, and it has been fine. Both happened to go to university. So university, I think, the birthing person did get tested for COVID upon admission. But the partner didn't.
Yeah,
I think the partner had to wear a mask, actually, if I'm remembering correctly. Everybody wore N95s until the test came back negative, and then they switched to surgical masks.
Yeah, our hospital is also doing tests on admission as well, and it doesn't really necessarily affect them, but it affects the staff, right? So if the person's test comes back negative, then the staff can kind of back down a little bit on the PPE. They still have to wear it, but they don't have to be as...
Right. They're wearing surgical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I thought it was, I wish we could offer tests so that we could wear surgical masks. I have zero patience for complaining about surgical masks anymore.
Yeah. No, after wearing the N95s that especially they suction cup to your face.
Yes.
They squish me.
Yes.
It peeks into my eyes.
Yes. And then also I never realized before how much lip reading I did, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't really have an official hearing deficit, I don't think, but when you have a mask on and the other person has a mask on and you're trying to talk to each other, oh my gosh, that's really bad.
And our team can't whisper in labor anymore. Like, we used to whisper little things like, go get this thing, or now we just have to talk, and it makes it really hard.
Yep. That is a big part of it that I've noticed too. Yeah.
Yeah. Stupid COVID. Stupid COVID.
It is stupid.
One other thing I wanted to talk about in your book, you talk a lot about the importance of culturally concordant care. What that means is having providers that have, similar background or lived experience as you. And that's a real challenge in Denver. And
it is.
I just thought maybe you would have
some thoughts. It's hard. I think I wish I had some great answer to that, but unfortunately I don't. I think we just need more midwives who aren't just... So I am a cisgendered, English-speaking, middle-income white person. So I have a ton of privilege, and I have all of that comes with me. And that's how most midwives are. I mean, when I look around at my midwife colleagues, that is the vast majority of us. And I think it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be midwives, and it doesn't mean that we're horrible, bad people, but I think we do need to pay attention and really do what we can to try and further people from other groups becoming midwives and removing barriers and really supporting in those ways that we can. Which is hard, and there is no magic answer. And I wish that there was just a really easy thing to do to make it better.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work examining your own privileges, examining your own behaviors and your own implicit bias and it's a lot of personal work, but then it's also about how do we solve this problem in our community?
It is. It's hard. And I have hired multiple midwives, because before the birth center that I opened 18 months ago, I ran another birth center and I was the director there for 6 years. And every time I would open up, have an opening for a midwife, right? And I would always be like, please, please, please let somebody. Why? and there wasn't, I think now there is more, absolutely, BIPOC people who are going through midwifery training, all the different kinds of midwifery training that there are. And so I think it's slowly but surely starting to become better, but we all have to be vigilant on it as well, and supporting people who are doing
that
work.
Right. It may or may not be that we have the opportunity to, officially precept somebody, but we can support people, economically or, financially. We can contribute to scholarship funds. We can contribute to testing fees. There's a lot of barriers in place. We can help at least break down some of the barriers or minimize some of the barriers. I did see that theme through your book as well. Are there any other kind of major themes that you want to talk about that you feel like we didn't touch on?
I mean, we talked a little bit about postpartum in the beginning, but it's definitely one of the things that I think really sets the midwifery model of care apart from other models, like the obstetric model that are out there. The sad thing to me, one of the saddest things to me in our maternity care system right now, is a person goes into the hospital, has a baby, maybe stays for 24 to 48 hours, and then goes home. and the baby has some appointments with a pediatrician or a pediatric care provider, a family practice doc, or whoever the family is going to have be the care provider for the baby. But nobody really sees the birthing person mm-hmm. for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is just a travesty mm-hmm. because so many things happen in those first 6 weeks. And if you discover them at 6 weeks, they've many times become too entrenched or deeply entrenched that you have to work really hard to get back out of. And then also that 6 week postpartum visit in the normal maternity care system right now is maybe 15 minutes, mm-hmm. maybe 20 minutes. Like what are the providers supposed to be able to do in that amount of time in having missed 6 weeks of, right. of stuff?
Right.
So that's one of the things that I think really sets community birth in particular apart is that close contact and level of care that happens in those first weeks, where if you have a little problem or a little issue, but you catch it at the beginning, you just do a little tweak, and then, you know, people can be off to the races. Mm-hmm. Mental health issues, breastfeeding mm-hmm. issues, postpartum physical issues, you know, postpartum preeclampsia is mm-hmm. real and is one of the biggest causes for maternal mortality. And that's why it gets missed.
Right.
Because these people have just gone through this massive physical event, and then they're just like, okay, bye, see ya in 6 weeks, like have fun with that. And to me, I just don't even understand it.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
It is crazy.
And so that's one of the things that really sets community birth apart. I have privileges in the hospital, and I worked in the hospital completely while I was doing those 2 years in the birth center to create it behind the scenes. And I did beautiful births at the hospital. I really did. I could really facilitate. I had a great relationship with the hospital staff and the nurses and the physicians there, and we could really facilitate some lovely births at the hospital. But then I was still constrained by that 6 weeks, see you later, hope things mm-hmm. go well with you. mm-hmm. And it used to kill me, and I hated it. And so the only thing that I could do was that I kept track of all the births that I attended, and I would call them at 2 weeks mm-hmm. just to check in and see how they were doing. And that's not even close to enough, but it was
and
what I
could do. And how many providers do that? Not very many.
Oh, no. No, yeah. That was me being,
yeah,
being a crazy midwife.
And shockingly,
but
this is sometimes true if people have had surgical births too.
Oh.
Sometimes they leave the hospital and still are not seen for 6 weeks after major abdominal surgery.
Yeah, the whole system in this country is set up not well.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's where community birth shines, and I think that's where we have some of our best outcomes. The measures, the qualities that are measured, you know, for across the different specters that we use to measure them. And I think that's one of the ways that community birth has the better outcomes that we do is because of that postpartum support and the in-depth nature of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Preach.
Preach.
Yep, you are. I agree. I mean, honestly, that's whenever my clients that have had a lot of babies have their first home birth, I'm always like, you are going to love this.
Yeah.
You just, because even besides the fact that the visit schedule is ridiculous and inadequate, the first 24 hours are also difficult. They, you know, the way that they provide care is not really conducive to this uninterrupted skin-to-skin contact.
No, it's not. No.
You know, getting off to a good start.
Yeah. I mean, we have so many families that come to us, and I'm sure you do too, that had a hospital birth, and they've said to me, the birth was fine. I felt fine about the birth. It was no big deal, but I was in misery after, like having to stay there for a day or 2 days, and you cannot sleep, and there's constantly people coming in and out. And then when you leave, you're just left with nothing, and nobody sees you again. So I think people who've had babies before, that's one of the reasons why they will choose a community birth the next time, is because of that postpartum issue.
Yeah, for sure. Like Dave Matthews said, it was great because you know where the beer is.
Yeah.
It's just my favorite quote from a celebrity.
Yes.
Well, all right. So again, the book is called Midwifery for Expectant Parents, A Modern Guide to Choosing the Birth That's Right for You. Aubrey graciously sent us a review copy, so we will put it in our lending library for clients to take out. And I'm sure you can buy it everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Wherever you can buy books online, you can buy it.
How exciting.
Are you going to narrate your own audiobook, Aubrey?
I don't know. I don't know if people want to listen to my voice for that long.
You know, it's interesting as you flip through, it'd be a perfect, you could get really bite-sized little snippets of, read a little bit here and there. It'd be perfect for a new parent.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the goal. It was written. Yeah. It's not written for midwives. It's written for consumers.
Yeah, but it's really good. I don't know. It's just really great. It's a quick read. There's birth stories. We all love birth stories. I think families like to hear experiences of others and actually student midwives thrive on birth stories and case studies and things like that. So.
And they're real birth stories. Names have been changed.
Yes, of course.
But they're 100% true birth stories.
Yeah, birth stories are it's a great thing to add. So
yeah.
And can you believe it? You wrote a book.
I know. I'm kind of still in shock about it. I mean, what?
Yeah. We didn't even ask you about the process of writing. When did you start?
I started in December, mid-December, and I had finished the first draft by the second week of February, and then through the second week of February into March was the edits there was like three different editors that it went through that all had different names that I don't know what they mean. There was like the primary editor that I worked with, and then there was a developmental editor and some other editor.
Not copy editor.
And they all had their things anyway. It was, it was a whirlwind situation that happened, but it was so great.
That is
great.
Fast. It's only early October now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, great. Congratulations. What an accomplishment. I bet it felt like you gave birth.
Yes. So I have three biological children, and then three kids. And then I have one of my kids is a stepkid, but I think of him as my kid. But anyway, so I have three children, and then I have the birth center seasons, and then I have this book.
Awesome. I bet that the book was less painful. It was probably like your second baby in the birth center. Like your prime at birth.
It wasn't as bad as a prime at birth, correct?
I bet that the practice guidelines and protocols alone are more than the book. Like, I bet that was painful.
That's longer.
Yeah.
Policy and procedure manual that I wrote for the birth center. Yeah, that was a lot too.
Well, thanks for joining us today. So we'll put a link on the blog post for where to find it,
perfect.
A couple different places.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us today.
And everybody listen to Mod Midwives podcast.
Oh, yeah. If you're listening to our podcast, you can find us on your favorite podcast player. Actually, it's not really true. I only did Apple, Google, and Spotify. There's some other ones out there, but I figured that was going to cover
90%. Those are the ones, yeah.
And Apple podcast is like 95% of the downloads.
Yeah, oops. Exactly.
There goes my phone. Sorry. All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Bye. Thanks, Aubrey.
Bye.
Bye.